Again, a badquaker.com podcast. This is podcast number, why don't I have that in front of me? 238, and it's for Thursday, November 29th, 2012. I'm actually recording this on Wednesday because I have a guest on the line, Randall Perry. Randall, thanks for coming on the show with me.
Sure. I'm glad to be had there.
And I should jump right in and just explain what it is about you that is fascinating and why my listeners want to hear more about you. You have a company called, is it Maddie Mac. Oh, I'm adding extra letters here. Maddie Mac. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to read down the list here of some of the things that you do under the heading of secure storage solutions, mm-hmm. Hidden in-wall lockboxes, hidden in-wall rifle cabinets, hidden in-wall electronic locking pistol safes, covert storage using ordinary objects in plain sight. I love that.
Yeah.
Under seat gun safes for cars and boats, electronic hidden complete gun racks available at touch. At touch of panic button, biometrics or code. Before I just keep on reading down this list, mm-hmm. This is really cool stuff. Even if I wasn't into all the liberty thing and afraid of my government coming and getting me and all these, you know, even if I wasn't the paranoid person that I am, I really like that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I started doing that, was because it was an interest of mine, not as a financial endeavor to make more money, but because, things interest me with firearms and being mechanically minded. I like to build things and like to see how machines work. So it's interesting that I find that a lot with people that I encounter in the liberty movement, is that first off, we're Linux users. And secondly, they love firearms and they like to see how things work, understand that, or they have an engineering mindset, very logical. So, yeah, it blends well together.
Describe some of the ways that, because this says, where did it go? Oh, there it is. Covert storage using ordinary objects in plain sight. Explain how that works.
Sure. And to give you a little idea of where my perspective comes from, I have a really varied background, and I had a podcast on that a while ago. Someone interviewed me about that. But one of the things that helps me with this covert storage and putting things in plain sight is I'm also part of the International Brotherhood of Magicians, and I have performed shows in the past. And so I'm actually a magician also, but I don't do that primarily for money. But so with that, there's things with magic where it always is right in front of someone's face, and whether it's a gaffe or requires some kind of device to help you, it's trying to use things that don't draw attention. So with that kind of mindset, it adapts to people trying to hide things in plain sight that are of value to them, not because they're trying to get by with a trick or something. An example of that that you could make on your own, even without having a purchased storage solution, is taking a number 10 can of green beans, cutting out the bottom, and using that for storing documents or certain things. That's not a real high security solution, but stashing that in a cabinet with a bunch of other canned goods is a cheap way to hide things right there. And other ways are where you have like a oh, you can buy like those shaving cans, and you can buy those. You don't have to make those yourself. And they have a screw-in bottom, and it says like Barbasol on it. And to make sure that that looks authentic, if you put that in your bathroom, you want to spray some other shaving cream on the outside of it to look a little bit messy, to not make it look like it's something that people want. What's different than with magic is that in magic, in performing illusions for people, you have control over the objects, you have control over the room or over the audience, and you can steer things. When you're trying to secure things from people's view, you might not be there at all. So you want to kind of paint the scenario for any kind of mindset of a person, whether it's a meth addict breaking into your house or whether it's unlawful entry for men in costumes that don't have a warrant. They're looking for whatever propaganda or Hurricane Katrina, and they're confiscating lawfully owned firearms. So I'm not doing anything to subvert any kind of legal precedence or authority. But you want people to hide things from anywhere from a tweaked out meth head to somebody who has a specific object in mind they're looking for. So you don't want to put out there something that they might inadvertently grab that they would take, not knowing that it has a handgun in there or silver bullion or something like that. One of the things that I gave my daughter, Andy, and she just grabbed one of our safes from the office, you know. So she grabbed one of those book safes that has a combination lock built into the end of it. But if you put it on a bookshelf, it looks like an ordinary book. And she puts her candy in there, and it's good to keep, you know, she's 11 years old. So it's it keeps the friends who come over of another daughter of mine from getting into her candy stash, because in the past they'd go through and, you know, so I'd give her either an electronic safe or like that book one. They're not going to read an engineering book, and that's what it is. So that's not something they would normally grow. So hiding things in plain sight is something that needs to fit in place. You're not going to have, an object you're going to put, like in a bathroom, you don't put a Pringles can that's a secured Pringles can or a shaving cream can in the kitchen. And you also might not put a hidden Bible, you know, with a compartment in it in a house of an atheist. Things have to wash. They have to make sense. So,
yeah.
And it has to be also something that you don't forget where it's at, or it's so covert and hidden that it's behind one of the panels and you don't remember which one it is. You know, so you can make things super confusing for yourself, but the key and the beauty of it is to make it where it was just right there, you know, and but they'll never get it. And that's what I would see with doing illusions, is that it's a joke if people understood how it would work, how simple it is. But you paint that picture for them so well that they just completely are confounded by it. Part of that too is having those decoys. I heard in a podcast that you did before with having a jar of pennies and then and having the matchbook. And that is a great tactic. And that's exactly what you want to do, with firearms. Okay. So if you're doing, an end wall, and we can talk in a few minutes about, placement of where things should really go. Having a device is one thing, knowing where to put it so it's accessible and it's more easily hidden. That's another scenario. It's another topic. But so when you have the proper device that you want to use to, you know, hide whatever it is, firearms, for example, I wouldn't put all of them in there. We'd like to have like your jar of pennies scenario with a decoy. Mm-hmm. If you have another safe, and they're not technically safes, the thin cabinets that are cheap metal, they look like filing cabinets. Those are just cabinets. They're gun cabinets. And those are typically $79 retail to $150, and they'll store anywhere from 6 to 12 guns, depending on who it is, what configuration. They're from like Stack-On and companies like that. What I would do with one of those is put one of those out. And they're not real aesthetically pleasing, so you'd put it like in a basement or something that's not a living room cabinet, and you'd put in there like an airsoft gun, an old 22. Those are giveaway throwaway firearms, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And throw in some dud ammo or empty shells. You need to make it look like that is the stash. So if someone knows that your home has firearms, they're going to look and look until they find the cabinet. And I know of people who've had their safes stolen out of their house, and I mean real safes that are 500-600 pounds. And it's interesting how much ingenuity comes out of a criminal mindset when they could put that to a good cause and to a functional job. But when they want to steal from somebody, they come up with different methods. A guy up in Michigan, just over the border where I'm at, he has he's a gunsmith. He's also an NRA training counselor, TC. And I did some of my search through him. And anyway, he's an old timer. He's been around for a long time. He had a cabinet stolen out of the house, and they live in a remote rural area. But the way the criminals got it out was the safe was sitting on the main level against an outside wall. The thieves took a chainsaw and buzzed in from the outside of the house and went along the house until they hit the safe. Then they went up and then over and came in from the other side, cut it out, broke into the house, ran a chain around the safe, hooked it up to a pickup truck and yanked it through the side of the house and drug it down the road.
Wow. I've heard of things like that happening with ATMs at stores and things. But
oh, that's exactly right.
That's the first time I heard of that happening in a house.
Oh, yeah, and it trashed the gun and the safe, too, because that stuff was recovered, but the firearms were pretty much rattled up pretty bad from taking that trip. But you know, if someone's really determined, they're going to get it. There is no such thing as a secure computer. There's no such thing as an unimpenetrable fortress either. If it's at that point, there's no way you can get in or out. And so you have to make it realistic. You know, if you're securing your home, you can't have it be such a tight fortress that it's totally, no one will ever get in there. If that was true, you'd never be able to get in when you came home from work, because there has to be some point, you know, where you open it up. And safes also, if they're that secure that no one would ever be able to break into them, well, then that means that you would never be able to get into it either. So
yeah, this is an old hacker philosophy that I really believe in, that, you know, if somebody can make a system, if somebody can make a lock, if somebody can make anything, you know, a computer system, anything, if one person can make it, another person can hack it.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a lot easier to break stuff than it is to build that up. Ask any toddler, when you're building a little Lego village and they come along and destroy it, it takes much less effort. One of the things that I picked up in growing up, I came from a blue collar background, all steel mill workers, you know, and so I was the first one to go through college, but everyone else was, you know, mechanics, things like that. My dad was a heavy machinery mechanic working on cranes and dump trucks. So I started working on engines when I was in elementary school, like 5-6 years old. And so I get part of my mechanical mindset from there. But I share that with you because I had to adapt, you know, things that we were making, parts, whatever, working on a carb on the mini bike or working on cars. Well, when we got our own vehicles when we were 15 years old, you would swap out locks, you know, on vehicles. It wasn't a big deal. You'd break a key off or lose keys or not a big deal. We'll just go to the junkyard and go get, you know, a whole cylinder out, pull off the C-clip, and would swap our own locks and redo that. So I taught myself how to pick locks, to build Slim Jims and use Slim Jims. And I like to know how the devices work to get into them. And I've been able to, you know, just on the side with my, you know, own lock set, open up all kinds of locks for anybody, and including like arcade machines and cabinets. These are lawfully owned, you know, by the people, security cabinets, drawers, whatever, because it interested me how they work. That's why I did it. But then when people lock themselves out of cars, it's like, no big deal. I'll get that for you. And it doesn't matter if it's a new car with, you know, they have all these anti-theft measures. What really gets me is I have to understand how it works. It really just, it drills at my mind that I have to figure that out. And once you understand how that works, the mechanism that people put so much thought and effort into with security, it's mostly a wish. It's a fiction. It's a hope that they believe that it's secure. So don't try to go after what you believe is the most secure thing out there. Because in reality, nothing's impervious. So guys who have like 24-gun gun safes, and they spend $1,000 on it, and then someone yanks that out of their home, they've lost a lot. And it's not just with the material gains. They emotionally get totally destroyed because they put all of their hopes in this, and that my security is wrapped up into this inanimate, fireproof object that is impenetrable. Well, in your mind, get out of that. Get away from that. Understand that anything can happen. So you have to have contingency plans set up for that. And if you understand how things work or how people get around that, then you won't put so much blind faith into things that are sold as the catch-all, sell-all best thing out there, whether it's computer security with firewalls, or you're talking about security devices or locks, or the high-end locks that are supposedly pick-proof. You know, some of the best-built locks are the easiest ones to jump with bump keys because of their tight tolerances for manufacturing.
You know, this reminds me in an odd direction. You mentioned a sleight of hand and so forth a minute ago, and this whole direction of the discussion reminds me of a situation that I'm sure you're familiar with James Randi.
Oh yes, he just died a few years ago here.
Yeah, he had a situation with what was his name? Was it Yuri Gelder? Am I thinking of the right guy? The guy who bends spoons.
It sounds right. I don't remember the last name, but Yuri. I don't remember.
Yeah. Anyway, he had gone before, if I recall, and I could be a little fuzzy on the details of the story, but he had gone before some actual scientists that were with like Stanford Research or someplace like that. And he had done a couple of real simple, basic magic tricks for them. And they were so confident in their knowledge of physics, and they were so confident in their ability to spot, you know, anything that wouldn't that wasn't right, that Yuri was able to just basically do some simple sleight of hand tricks, and they were convinced that he was this great psychic, and that he was really doing this. And James Randi just went to him and said, well, "What did he do? He did that? Well, this is how you do it." And they were just stunned. And it's because they had put so much faith in their own ability to not be fooled. But anybody can be fooled, really. And that's all a lock really is of any kind. A lock is just something to, the old saying was, a lock is to keep honest people honest.
That's right. Because it will not stop a determined person. And it is funny when you bring that up about the magic side of it. There are certain people who, it's kind of like either the know-it-all mentality or someone who does understand how things work, and they get very upset when you do something that they didn't catch it, or you had the angles just right. And I remember one kid when I did, basically it was an impromptu torn and restoring thing. I did this on a trip. It was a number of years ago here, and you can see the puzzled look on his face, and he was just, he could figure it out, and his brain overloaded. And then he just said, "You're not magic. You're not magic." And he kept yelling to like to convince himself. I'm like, "I know, dude, it's just a gaffe," but I wouldn't tell him how I did it, which makes them even more angry. You know, it's just funny. Some people can just enjoy it and understand that, yeah, you know, you can work me over. And other people, they get so angry about it. And those are the ones who think they have everything figured out. And I'll tell you what, folks, it's when you think you have everything figured out, you don't. And when you think you have everything totally taken care of, whether you think you're protecting your home because I own a firearm. Oh, that's good. You have a firearm. That's quaint. That's cute. Do you train with it? Do you train with it under duress and under stress and in bad conditions? Do you know how to actually secure and protect your family? Because that, you're living a dream if you think that you're taking those steps. Because once you do that, and if you get to the point of doing, force-on-force training, or you go through drills and practices of what happens if there's a home invasion, what happens if, you know, worst-case scenario, like even bug-out conditions for there's a tornado or fire, whatever, knowing that you've covered as many bases as possible, but you don't have everything covered, that you're just trying to do your best preparations, but you know that it's never complete. You know, there, if it helps people to sleep at night because they want to just feel secure, that's that same troubled mindset that gets people where they're willing to subvert and sell out liberties for their temporary mental safety. When you know it's a fiction, you know it's not real. They're not really safe, but it feels safe if they're surrounded by people willing to grope them with rubber gloves on at the airport and to probe them because it's stopping this made-up character that's willing to take them down. And I'd rather live in reality. You know, I'd rather be well-grounded with realistic expectations of what it takes to protect my family, which is first and foremost, and to provide for them, and then mitigating risks as best as possible, and then understanding that, you know, I won't always be successful, and I'll have some contingency plans, but there's times where I'm just going to roll with the punches, move forward, and keep pressing forward, you know. So it's interesting when people get just hung up with that, and they're just and they think that it's in their tight little world that everything just makes sense for them, and that's a dangerous mindset to be in.
It really is. This is a good time to break and save the file, and we'll sew in a commercial here, and we'll come back in just a minute. Hold on, folks. We'll be right back.
Did you know author Taryn P. Lupo has a new novel out called One Nation Under Blood? When a rejuvenative blood technology is developed that pits the young against the old, the government must take firm steps to address the war of supply and demand brewing across generational lines. Blood is not the only thing bought and sold in this dystopian tale of technology, economics, and independence. Vampires are now very real, but we never expected them to wear our grandmother's best Sunday dress.
Okay, thanks for sticking with us through the break. I'm with Randall Perry. And the name of your business, and I'll try to get it right this time, Matamac. And there will be links on today's show notes to both of your business websites. And the other one we didn't mention is it Domain Logic Technology Solutions?
Yeah.
And I'll put links to that as well. Before we get into that, though, let's pick back up where we were just talking, because that's really... this is really a great connection here between people believing that they're safe and people actually being safe. And really, there's no such thing as being 100% safe, 100% secure. There are only steps that you can take to give you an advantage. And any time that you're told that you are secure, you're being sold something. You're being lied to. You're being conned by somebody. All we can really do is take steps so that we can be in a better situation than we would be without those steps, right?
Absolutely right. That the reality is that you shouldn't want to be in that simple-minded scenario. You shouldn't want to have to feel better about yourself. I'm not sure what it is. It's an internalized condition that makes them feel warm and fuzzy, and I don't know why that is. I think it's because it's more based on emotion than it is on logic or reason, and perhaps that's why that's their fetal position, mother's milk kind of comfort level of existence. And I really just can't fathom how that's comfortable for people where they don't want to. It goes along with the whole idea of being free, and that's really what it's all about. And liberty is not about exercising with permission certain aspects of your life that I didn't really care at all about that aspect anyway. They can tell me what to drink or to wear a seatbelt. It's for my protection. And that's daft. That's really out there that people don't want to take the initiative and take responsibility for their own life. And I believe atheists should appreciate that. I'm not an atheist, but I believe that in the Old Testament book of Genesis, that was all about free will. And the basis of Christianity, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, wasn't knowledge per se. It was about choosing free will and having the consequences for your actions on your own shoulders and not somebody else. So with that mindset, I don't know how you can say that you would ever have a Christian form of government when you have all these mandates on soda and on, 18-inch barrels of firearms with NFA of 1934, and where you have all these restrictions where you're not letting people make their own mistakes and determine their own life. So it to me, that just sounds very topsy-turvy, reprobate mindset kind of thing.
Yeah, it's very much backward thinking to me anyway, to believe that. I don't know. I try to understand, you know, the other side of any particular argument. I try to understand the other side of it, so that I can find the weaknesses in that argument, and to also know the strengths in my own argument. But when I really think about the justification for trusting, you know, a group of people that we call the government, trusting them for my security, trusting a committee of people who are going to sit down and decide, well, these laws are good for you, and these, but this is not good for you. We're going to say that, you know, you have to behave like this, build your house like that, drive your car like this, raise your kids like this over here. And I just can't understand how people would have faith in a committee's ability to do that for you. Rather than, you know, trusting in your own responsibility and being responsible to yourself.
Sure. Frederick Bastiat had said something along the lines of, with these men, are they made of a finer clay than what we are, that they have these – he didn't phrase it this way. I'm going to paraphrase here – that they have these superhuman abilities that you can't have, to where they have the knowledge and the insight to be able to – do something that you're too inept to do for yourself. And that's what it's a logical fallacy when people want to argue the just position of a state, or the fact that people feel that they need to be led, is that if a government truly is of the people, right, then how are they a finer people? If they're still flawed like you and they make poor decisions, well, then why would you want them making poor decisions for you? Because we've already determined that humans are fallible. We don't know everything. So how can a committee of fallible, don't know everything people can somehow have a greater good for the greater group? And that's directly getting sidestepped into, you know, the Karl Marx area and the 10 planks of communism, where they start talking about the benefit of the whole at a sacrifice of the individual. Well, if you can't have it both ways, either as individually you're failed, so the collective will also be failed. If one piece of bread is moldy, you can't stick it into a loaf and somehow that's better. You know, the whole thing is corrupt.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking, if you have a group of 10 people, and among those 10 people, none of them are qualified surgeons, none of them know anything about medicine, none of them have a medical background, but you have a person who desperately needs surgery, well, adding an 11th or 12th or 15th person that knows nothing about surgery doesn't help your need to have somebody who knows something about surgery. By having a greater majority doesn't add something to the mix that the individuals don't have on their own. But if you have one individual who has that ability to do surgery, then having 15 others standing there being, you know, as part of a committee are only going to hinder him anyway, because they don't have anything specialized, you know, they don't have that specialized knowledge.
Right. Why should you take the hit for someone else's mistakes? Because they don't learn from their mistakes if you're the one who's taking the repercussions. If they make, you know, if they're poor fiduciaries of their own financial resources, and, you know, if you make a personal mistake, then you're personally going to take the hit. So you learn not to do that. You learn not to pay credit card bills late, or to get into debt, or get too high interest rate, because you don't like what it does to your lifestyle. You don't like what it does to the rest of your livelihood by having those burdens and having to live with the mistakes. But when someone else, you know, is distant from that, and they can make all the poor decisions and mistakes they want because there are no consequences to their actions, they're not being held accountable. And that's it's insanity is the best way to describe that, because it doesn't have any rational background behind it. You know, it's completely illogical of how people arrive at that point. And you said that sometimes that It helps to hear that position so you can help formulate your own, either refine and sharpen your own perspective or form a counterargument. And sometimes, I don't know, you get too mired down with those people and I just can't take it. I have to go read some or, you know, listen to some Freedom Fiends or Bad Quaker to kind of clean the palate there to get back to reality. Because with all the nonsense out there, and if you have that come inundating you every day, sometimes it's I don't want to say that makes sense, but it just wears you down. You know, it just wears you down. That turning up the boiling temperature on that frog there so they get acclimated to it. And it's just it's just an interesting place to be. And I think that's why that now we live in interesting times, because the con's off for a lot of people. They get it, and yet it gets bigger. And, you know, it's kind of like a magic show, and the guy's pulling out these gaffes that wouldn't fool 5-year-old kids, and yet this captive adult audience is completely just, just ingrained, and just they're just dead on as an audience, and you're laughing at it like, how stupid are you? This isn't even magic anymore. This is just, you know, like the split finger and thumb coming off your hand. Ooh, wow, look at this. I've actually did that for adults, and it freaked them out. I was laughing because it's a gaffe for, like, you know, kindergartners and that. But I had adults in their 30s and 40s who had never seen that before.
I love sleight of hand, and I like, you know, magic shows and stuff like that. And I really like that whole thing. I would love to have the dexterity with my fingers to be able to do that kind of stuff. But then I watch somebody like, you know, okay, so this guy is going to make the Statue of Liberty disappear. And no, he's not. They just changed the camera angles. It, you know, they broke for a break and they came back and it was, and they have a different camera angle. That's not magic. That's a different camera angle. No, that's
like the Chris Angel stuff, because, and I know people that know him, and he has an interesting gig as far as he's paid very well to basically repackage a bunch of tricks. Or, and there's some of his stuff was developed by college kids, like more recently, like the coin in the Coke can was, and he did that like 3 years ago. Some of it's old stuff, though. The things you see on television, though, are mostly total angles that if you were there, it's not even a magic trick. It's like, what are you people looking at? And so they pay like 30 stooges to stand around. And to me, that's not magic. For somebody watching at home, they think that that's great and believable. But knowing how everything works, it's just, you're not a master of your trade when you rely on special effects and camera angles and things you couldn't get away with in real life, and then you're panning off the reactions of the people as being authentic, and I just don't like that. I do enjoy the real stuff up in your face, whether it's what they consider now street magic, which was up close magic a few years ago, or table hopping magic, which is up close. And some stage stuff, if it's not done on a massive stage, and they're using it with the cameras to hide what you're really doing that you couldn't get away with in person, because it takes a certain craft to make those things happen. There are a lot of self-working like gimmicks, and if people don't work them right, then it gets played off horrible. They destroy the show. You exposed what it is. I know a guy that they invent different things that get used by like David Copperfield or any mainstream magicians, and everyone learns to use them, and it's a great tool, but in the wrong, unpracticed and untrained hands, you expose the gaff to everybody else. And one of those showed up on one of those talent shows. I think it was like the America's Got Talent or one of those big talent shows that is televised, and you'll get magicians up there too. And some of these guys, I hear from them, and it's they're almost wanting to just sob because there's someone using their tool and using it completely wrong, and it comes off horrible. And then other ones that do really well at it, if they're really proud of that, and they appreciate that even though they were the machinist behind that idea and figured out the mechanics, these people put a spin on it with storyline and just the present presentation of it just blends it really well together, and it's a beautiful presentation. And then you don't even care that you got fooled. You're like, wow, that was just really well done. Even if you knew how it worked, that was really well done. You know, that well played. You know, sometimes you want to give that same attaboy to the state. You're like, you know what? Who would have ever believed that? That's a great cover. That was just brilliant. You know, you fooled the masses and did it brilliantly. Not like the Benghazi thing or anything, you know, like that. That's horrible, horrible storyline going with the old standby script of there's an affair and let's throw that in face. But sometimes they come up with a brilliant ploy that fools the people. And even if you're not fooled, you're like, wow, that was a great concerted effort. Well done. You're still... You're still a fascist statist, but well played, sir. Well played.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about Penn and Teller's famous gun trick that they do. Have you ever seen that in real life?
I have not seen that live.
I really want to. I haven't either. I really want to see it in real life. I'm told by people who have seen it that it really looks good. It really looks like they're shooting each other, you know? I know it's fake. I know there's a trick. I don't know what the trick is, and I still like watching it, not because I think I'm going to figure it out, and not because I believe it's real. It's that every time it's like, you fooled me. Look at this. This is great. And that's the essence of, to me anyway, that's the essence of watching, you know, magic like that, is that this is just so well done. And it's not, they're not just turning off the camera and sticking a bullet in their mouth and then smiling at the camera, you know. They really put mechanics into this, and they're accomplishing, you know, magic in the real sense. Like, it's not fairy dust or whatever, but it's magic in your mind that is really, really amazing. I love that. But I know what you mean. When somebody... attempts to pull off something like, we'll just be diverted because there's sensationalism of a woman and accusing another woman in emails and there's details about a dress that might have DNA or all that stuff is, it's really cheap and it's insulting that, I'm not looking at that. I'm not fooled by that. That doesn't work anymore.
Or it's like having a late night host from today's time pulling out an old Johnny Carson ad lib and delivering that material. And you're like, this sounds really dated and old. Where have we heard that before? Oh, yeah. Come on. Can't you take the effort to at least make it believable? Put a little bit of effort. We know you're acting. We know that you're it's a big fiction. So at least put some effort into it. Make it look like you tried. So it seems like they're just giving up. They're like, people are stupid. The sheep will buy it. Whatever.
Yeah, I was thinking, and this is totally unrelated, but the old comedian who's been dead for a long time, Red Skelton, he would take old Marx Brothers routines, and then he would rewrite them, put them in a different setting, and put them into his movies, and he pulled it off beautifully because he gave it his own flavor, and he made it in the context of his movie. And you could actually watch, be very comfortable knowing Marx Brothers movies and then watch the Red Skelton movie and not realize that he just did that to you, you know, because he was such a master at it.
Yeah, that's a great example of that. That's a great example. You know that you mentioned Penn Jillette, and he is a huge libertarian as well. And it's something about that mindset. People who think logically and rationally, and they just find themselves into that liberty movement because they're seeking out that thing that's gnawing away at them at the back of the mind, that they have to find out what that is. And I don't think that we ever truly understand what that means with the real freedom. When you talk, you know, we could talk about your natural rights and the essence of man, but we never will truly understand what that condition is. We've never been there, so it'd be hard to kind of take a vision of what that means, what that all envelops, and what that would be like. But it's certainly good trying to get there and trying to approach that and throwing off the facade that's you know, continually pushed at you because you know that it's not real and you're pushing at it. So that understanding, you know, where our discussion is going kind of paints a picture around where my perspective's at, where I'm coming from for how I do things. That's how I address solving problems. I've been paid to solve problems for many years. You know, I've been doing, I've done a lot of things in my background. I've done anything from repossessing cars to being a paralegal when I was in college, a farm tech, and I was a licensed financial analyst with the SEC. I did investing, but yeah, it was okay on this. But the reason why I bring that up is that my very background was I would use the same kind of logic and reasoning to get me to basically fix things or look at it with what people saw as a fresh perspective, but it's really looking at things with discernment and going through it in not such a mechanic, methodical manner that it's book scripted where you're going through it, but trying to understand what's behind it. So for the last 17 years, I've done tech consulting. And, you know, I get pulled into things that I don't have any background in, and that's fine. And then I just put I just put my spin on things for how we're going to figure this out, whether it's, you know, I built a reverse logistics line for a large outlet that does like retail video rentals, that kind of thing. They're huge and they're out of Oregon, and they had a lot of game consoles. They had over 13,000 pieces, Xboxes and PlayStations, that had to be fixed. Well, I came up with a way to remanufacture those, and I had an assembly line that I built, and they shipped over things in a truckload, and we built them, kicked them out. And it's funny that they didn't do that on their own, and they were paying for all the space to house things, and because they couldn't assemble the same thing. Well, all I did was address that problem the way I do everything else, to look through not what the symptoms are, but to look underneath that, to look for what's really driving that. What the, at the surface, we see these symptoms of problems in that, but I want to go deeper than that to understand what's causing that, because we don't want to treat symptoms. And you could be talking about health. You could be talking about, you know, problems with network security or performance. You have to separate out what those symptoms are at the top and really get to the cause of it. And you can apply that to anything. You can apply that to even the, you know, the liberty movement. And you see the symptoms that are at the surface where there are more rights being denied. Why? Get underneath it and keep going until you find out why it keeps changing faces or changing flavors, or why gun control happens with outright legislation like the GCA of 1968 or the NFA of 1934 or the Lutenberg Amendment tacked on for the assault weapons ban. Those are symptoms. What's really driving it behind it? And it's that progressive mindset that keeps pushing it up. And if you don't address that and why people feel the need to control other people, then it will manifest itself in these different areas.
That's great. That's absolutely correct. Let me go ahead and break and save this file, and we'll come right back on the other side. And thanks for sticking with me through the break. With me is Randall Perry, and we're going to talk about a little bit about his businesses and what he does. And again, you can find links on badquaker.com in the show notes for today's show, and find the links to his businesses and get a hold of him, hire him, give him money, and he'll do great stuff for you. So, but before we get into that, I wanted to tell a joke. We were talking about magicians and sleight of hand and everything. And there's this old joke, and I can't remember who I stole this from, but the way it goes, that you've got this cruise ship, and this magician is doing an evening act on the cruise ship. And the captain of the cruise ship is in attendance every night at the theater. And so the magician's on stage, and he tries a basic card trick, and the cruise ship's parrot that always sits right on his shoulder right there just goes, "It's in his pocket," you know, and the magician's like, "Rats, he busted me." And so then the magician tries a different thing. He's going to like saw the lady in half or whatever. And everything that he tries to do, the parrot busts him on it. You know, "There's a string attached," or "It's got a false bottom," or, you know, whatever it is. Every single trick that the magician tries, the parrot busts him on it. And the magician's just getting madder and madder. And it's like the third night of the show, and everything is getting busted by this stupid parrot. And right at that time, the cruise ship hits an iceberg, and within minutes, it goes down. The only two survivors are the parrot and the magician, and they're floating on a piece of wreckage. And the magician's just looking at this parrot, and the parrot's just looking at the magician. And day after day goes by, and they keep floating. It comes to the third day, and the magician's just staring at the parrot, and the parrot's just staring at the magician. And the parrot says,
"Okay, I give. Where'd you put the cruise ship?"
You know, and it's all in the buildup. It's a stupid line, but it's all in the buildup.
Well, that's all. So.
And thanks for stopping in at the one-liner podcast, where we tell old goofy jokes.
Yeah, I got happy tappy. Let's unwrap the next one, and that is Bazooka Joe jokes.
Yeah. Okay, so now you've got two different businesses. One is you explain to me about your two businesses.
The one that has been my breadwinner for a number of years here that I've done, and then I went back into like working for large corporations to run IT, that kind of thing. Then I'd get back out and be back on my own. I just really like being self-determined and self-employed. I do tech consulting. So I roll out voice over IP systems or EMR systems for doctor's offices, for medical records management, do premise wiring for large buildings. That includes everything from, like, if we do a building that needs to be hooked up for technology, I literally will also be the guy trenching the lines through the ground, going to the building. Have my guys running the cables in the building for all the networking, phones, paging, whatever's needed, certify the installation, and then also put in the equipment and set that up. So building VPN concentrators, servers, and then managing that stuff. So that's stemmed off of me working on computers. I started writing code when I was 13, and that was many years ago, on the old Apple IIcs and IIes and the Cocoa 3, you know, the Tandy stuff, the Trash 80, those kind of things. And that's what drives me day to day. And I like it because it keeps me active and challenging with unique problems. I'll have the phone companies, large providers in the area calling me when they have client problems. And I get to help troubleshoot big things. I don't like doing the remedial stuff, you know, but because I like to have continual sharpening of my skill set. So to have fresh problems in that to address problems with whatever systems are up there. So what I did was earlier this year, I decided that it was finally time. I've kicked around the idea for years to have an FFL, a federal firearms license, and friends of mine and myself. These are things that interest us, and collecting, shooting, hunting, and all of that. And so I saw a need coming up. I saw the need in, you know, before the 08 election. I knew that would happen. I knew that the SKS prices would skyrocket, and the AKs, and I sold a couple of AKs, and it was funny because how much they were going for, and the market was really hot. There was an artificial demand, but there was a demand there nonetheless, and I knew that would perpetuate. And so there's also a lacking side to that. Then people get firearms, but they don't know how to use it. And some states, like in Ohio, for a concealed carry license, you have to have some kind of training. And in Michigan, they have to have a mandatory 8-hour course, and it has to be from an approved curriculum before they can get their CPL. Indiana, with their LTCH, they don't require that, but certain states require that. So I wanted to do that because I like training. I actually was a professor for, 10 years ago. I taught at the university level for computer science and developed curriculum for a number of colleges, universities around for networking, computer stuff. So I liked engaging with people. I like teaching. I've spoken at oh, like tech conventions, that kind of things on integration security. So I'm used to being around the public as far as I don't have any problems speaking in front of a group. So I thought it would be great and complement my other skill set to teach firearms. And so I wanted to teach people the requirements for getting their licensing, but also other things for home security. And then that lent into this other area for what I do with Maddie Mac Security was that, you know, folks need to know not just how to safely operate and follow the gun safety rules and how to clean their firearms or store it for short versus long term. But there's other scenarios that when I do things, I kind of take it for granted, whether it's modifying a car or a computer or hacking a phone. It's people just are like, wow, I had no idea that's how it's done. And I would kind of just think, oh, I'm sorry. I just let those things slide. And like I did, not to segue too much here, but when I lived out of the country, I also did translations. This was back in 94. And it would be funny because you go through a museum and I'm listening, but I forget to translate for somebody because I'm engaged into the conversation, but I'm supposed to be passing information through. It's like, oh, sorry about that. Ooh, let me catch you up here. I'm like, oh, and it's that way with some of the ideas and the principles that I put into, like for firearm storage and safe rooms, that kind of thing, is that doesn't everyone know this? Doesn't everyone know that you hide things like that behind mirrors or, you know, under vanities or there's, and they don't, and they don't think that way. They don't think that, oh, I could put a hidden hinge here and that would still allow me to pivot this out and yet no one would know it. And this would be load bearing enough. And they don't think about, you know, how to do that. But that's what I think about those things. So I thought, hey, if I took those things, it would tie well into the business because you don't like having, either you don't like having firearms out in the open because you don't think it's aesthetically appealing. I do, but my wife doesn't. So, or maybe you you want to be more secure. So there's a lot of ways we come up with looking at what the real problem is. They want to conceal it or they want it to be readily accessible. Okay, well, what if it's you're in your car, we can do this and that. You know, I have an airbag I pulled out of one of my cars and they dashed and I'm putting a compartment in there to pop out. But I just like coming up with scenarios. So like building safes that pop up out of tables or, you know, behind furniture. Sometimes you just want the kind of like the wow factor too for people. And it's somewhat practical, somewhat not. You can use, you know, hydraulic lifts to assist with that. But sometimes you want to just vamp it up a little bit, put a code on it. So they type a code in and then you either have like an Arduino controller that controls to tell it to, hey, actuate this, run this lift up, and then whoop, here's a rack of guns that pops up from behind your couch. And it's just cool. It's a cool factor, but it's also practical, you know. So I like to build things and for specific needs, you know. So that's really what I did with the with coming up with the safe solutions in that. We also do we do like hidden wall compartments and storage that's pre-built, where someone else had manufactured it and, you know, it looks like a circuit breaker panel, whatever. And then we'll put those in. But if someone has unique needs for hiding something, you know, then we can make that happen. And that's applying principles of magic and principles of just the mechanical side of it and making it aesthetically pleasing. I've had to do things like that, not even with, you know, we do it with guns now, but I've had to do it in the past when we retrofit these houses. I mean, there's old buildings that these companies take over. And if it's in a historic section, then you're talking about a building that's 90 to 100 years old. My own house is 112 years old. So you get interesting challenges with like plaster and slapboard in that. But I found ways to hide cabling without putting conduit on the outside of the wall to make it look all nasty. And people have no idea how you did it. And it's kind of funny if you told them because it's like a joke. Like either you pulled out their chair rail and put the trim up or pull out the baseboard and get, because it's low voltage, you don't have to put it in EMT. But to come up with these scenarios, looking at their unique setup and then coming up with a solution around it, and it's just kind of second nature. And they don't really care. They just care that it's not visible and that you took care of it, whatever it took to get there. So it's for me, I like that. I really enjoy, you know, making my mind work to come up with a solution that's functional. It's what they needed. Maybe it's not the way they thought they'd get there, but it's totally what they needed for, you know, the delivered solution.
I was recently looking on the internet for a locking mechanism of some kind that would be completely hidden and that there would be no pulls or, you know, keyholes or anything like that. And I was surprised how many solutions there are to that problem of types of locks where in the specific circumstance that I was looking at, I was I'm looking at creating a space where it's actually fairly obvious, but a person would go up and look at it, and even if they tried it, it would appear to be solid. But if you have, you know, the key, which in this case I didn't want there to be a keyhole, so if you have the device that's actually got a magnetic and it's coated, and you can just wave it in front of a specific spot on this area, then it opens the mechanism inside. And the whole thing opens up, and it's obvious where it's at.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised at how many solutions are on the internet, you know, locking devices that some of them you can use a remote control, just like a TV or whatever, and operate them. Others, you can have like a little ring on your key ring and just pass it in front of an area mm-hmm. that looks like it's solid. But behind that, there's a thing back there.
Yeah, some of that technology goes back many, many years. I mean, 50 years back, they would use them with magic boxes and compartments, things like that. They'd use a magnet itself. And like I have some of those too. I don't have one sitting here at the office, but they're rare earth magnets. They're made into other objects and they're very strong. And you could use it to pull through on the other side of wood to pull a catch and it'll open up. Otherwise, it won't work for people. But There's issues with using things that either rely on infrared light or on RF because if you have problems with that frequency, something jamming it or noise or you lose that device, then you have to have a backup way to get in there. Kind of like the on cars when you throw in a keyless entry system in there because they shave off your door handles. The guys usually use a really low-tech solution to bypass that when the remote fails, and that's they will hang leads in the wheel well that you could hook up to a 12-volt source to actuate the door, but they're not secured. There's no encrypted pattern for it to pulsate the DC on it. It's straight up positive and negative. You hook it up to a battery, and boom, it pops the door open, and you just have to reach in behind the wheel well, pull those two wires out. That's not very secure at all. You know, or they'll put a hidden button somewhere, and it's they go through all that work and engineering to come up with something that's really sweet. It looks great. It functions great. Oh, but what's your backup plan? Oh, we could just do this, and it completely subverts everything you've built. You're like, you can't make your home a fortress, and it's all secured, locked down, and we have biometric security at the doors. But what happens if that all fails? Oh, we just go through the storm cellar doors outside. It's not locked. You can go through there. What's the point of that then? Another thing you can do that's the concept was out a number of years ago. I think it came up in the 60s or 70s, the concept in like movies, but it wasn't practical at all. But it is practical now, and it's pretty easy to do for someone who is either a do-it-yourselfer, and you can do this with a safe room scenario or if it's for a compartment, and that's just doing like knock patterns. You can actually knock on the wall and there'll be a mic on the other side of it, and you can use an Arduino controller that will count for you. So you have a prescribed code, and you can knock with pattern, and then your door will secretly open to expand that passageway or to open up a secured box or panel. And that's a cool way to doing it where it's low technology on the user interface side, but it's actually really high technology on the actual implementation technical side of it for it to work. And it has that wow factor there, and it allows other people to have their own unique knock codes so you can enable or disable them or to know who it is or recognize them, you know, when they go to use that knock code to get into that room or whatever. I think it's a lot more reliable than the old ways of doing it. People have been doing this for thousands of years. This isn't the concept of hiding stuff and to put it into like even a safe room. That's not a new idea. So we borrow off these old ideas from like the what the Egyptians used to do, you know, with like the pyramids. Okay, they would have hidden rooms in there. I'm not really polished up on that. I studied it many years ago, you know, in college and in high school, with the whole culture about the Egyptians and with the reason why they had the body showing all of the limbs and the eyes, and that, which looked really weird. But they did that because they believed that if you were missing an arm and couldn't see it in the picture, that you wouldn't have that in the afterlife. They had all these weird things. They'd bury the people with their servants and bury them with their cats and all that. But to keep robbers from stealing all that stuff they buried with all these articles, they would have like hidden passages, hidden rooms. You know, they had these diversive tactics to take people off the path so they wouldn't find where the gold was at. And that has always gone through time, to where, yes, you do have a hidden passage, hidden room, you know, hidden compartment, but you want to not make it so obvious because it's not impenetrable. And so that also applies to like the citadels and castles, you know, or in ships. Like in castles, they would have a fortress, a secured room, so that if there's an attack, the people who thought they were better than everyone else would go hide themselves, and while the other guys were fighting. And in ships, even modern ships now, because of like the piracy in Somalia, is that they will have a citadel on the ship, which is basically a secured safe room that's going to be in, oh, it's way down in there into a secure place, so it's not an outside port that can be blown with a, you know, with a rocket or something like that. And it allows them to have communications equipment too, so if they're being attacked, they can have they can take refuge in that room, call for assistance, and they can also do things like disable the controls for the ship, power it down so that the ship can't be taken over and then steered over into another port or taken out of waters where there might be support, military support, or being able to intervene. So those ideas have always been there, And so what we're doing now is it's not really that ingenious. It's just doing what people did before, but, you know, spinning it with a new technology and making use of new materials, lighter materials, adapting and refining what's always been going on. You know, one of my favorite safe rooms to read about was the Anne Frank stuff. I remember reading that book when I was in high school, and they had a complete living quarters that they lived in all the time that was behind a bookcase in this factory, you know. That was like, to me, that's a very real, tangible use of one of those rooms. It wasn't gee whiz, it was life and death for them, you know. And you learn from the mistakes, you learn about what didn't work for people in the past, you learn about, and this is really disheartening, is in the more recent past, is with Waco.
Yeah, their safe room ended up being a death chamber for them.
Yeah, and their gas masks only lasted out for a few minutes, and I don't even know if they were trained anyway on how to properly blow out the masks and that before they sealed them, or if they got contaminants in there and then sucked them in. But those kids were all, you know.
Yeah,
it was a mess. So yeah, there's a lot of aspects to a modern room. Whether you're talking about what you learn about with having to pressurize it so things don't get in there and you're pushing, you know, particles out, or whether you're talking about blast safe doors, or you're looking at, you know, levels of the materials that you're using there, even the locks too, you know, that stuff's changed over time, and we're just refining these old ideas that people have had. So I love working with the mechanical stuff, you know, even with my firearms the same way. I love cowboy guns. I love lever actions. I like the it's not quite steampunk, you know what I mean? But it's the mechanical aspect of looking at this machine and how well it's manufactured and fit together and designed, and it functions again and again. So that's where my interest comes from.
Randall, I really appreciate you coming on the show, and it's been a fascinating subject. I think we could probably talk about this for hours, because I just love, just like what you just now brought up, that could take me in a whole nother direction, and we could talk about the beauty of machines and stuff. because it's something I really have an appreciation for, a well-built machine, you know. But thanks for coming on the show, and there's going to be links again at badquaker.com to your websites. And folks, be sure and get over there, click those links, and go to Randall's website and secure your stuff. Thanks for listening today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Randall.
Thanks for having me.